Welcome to How to Save Your Life. How to Save Your Life is produced with the assistance of the Department of Neurological Surgery, Weill Cornell Medical College, New York Presbyterian Hospital. Your host is Dr. Philip Stieg, Chairman of the Department of Neurological Surgery and Neurosurgeon-in-Chief at New York Presbyterian Hospital.
Are you obese or are you too thin? Today, we have a world authority on the management of obesity with us. We'll talk about myths and facts about obesity. What is obesity? Once you know you've got it, how can you stop it? Do the diet pills work? Do diets work? Stay with us as we talk about how you can manage obesity. Good evening and welcome to How to Save Your Life. I'm Dr. Philip Stieg, Professor and Chairman of the Department of Neurological Surgery at Weill Medical College, Cornell University. And tonight we are going to learn about the myths and facts about obesity. What is obesity? How do we avoid it? How can you protect your children? Once it happens, what can you do to reverse it? It's my distinct pleasure to have with me a world's expert on the subject of obesity, Dr. Louis Aronne. He is chairman of the Development Committee for the Principal Guide to the Identification, Evaluation, and Treatment of Overweight and Obesity in Adults. It's a joint publication of the National Institutes of Health, National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. He is also the former president of the North American Association for the Study of Obesity. He lectures internationally on the subject and has an international reputation. It's a distinct pleasure to have Dr. Aronne here with me this evening. Welcome, Louis.
Thank you very much, Phil.
So, this is a major healthcare problem that, from what I understand it, is exploding. What are some of the myths about obesity?
I think the major myth about obesity is that it's someone's fault, that people want to be obese. Why can't that person just help themselves? And the evidence right now is that when you're in the type of environment that we live in, one where there's less exercise and as much food as you can possibly imagine, that there are physical forces in your body that gradually favor weight gain. And there are some people who inherit this tendency, and other people just don't have that tendency. No matter what they do, no matter how little they exercise, no matter how much they eat, they will not gain weight. But it seems to be that we inherit this very, very commonly. That's why two-thirds of the population is either overweight or obese. And so the question is, what can we do about this?
It's really kind of surprising to me. I mean, if you go back into the 70s, I remember President Nixon, when he nominated George Allen as this physical fitness guru, and we had all of this stuff going on trying to reduce weight. So it's still a problem, in spite of the federal government's attempts to change this.
That's right. And the reason why I think we're not making progress is we haven't looked at this in serious enough way. And clearly, we haven't really understood body weight regulation. What are the issues that allow people to gain weight? Why does this happen? And we also, when we look at the environment and the commercial environment, the business environment, it's in going in favor of more weight gain. So companies, to increase their profits, have to sell more food. How do they sell more food? They have more commercials, and you get the picture.
You can't open a newspaper or a magazine nowadays looking at, you know, how to lose weight, the figures of beautiful women and attractive men. I'm concerned that many people think that they're obese or overweight, and they're really not. So, you know, what is obesity, and what is not obesity?
One of the problems we actually have is that we see these quote-unquote role models, actresses who are at an unhealthfully low weight, and those are our idols. And at the same time, the people who idolize them are at a high weight. They're at a weight that is above a healthy weight, and they're not doing anything about it. So they either don't recognize the problem, or maybe they're demoralized. We don't know why this is happening, but we have a part of the population. One-third of the population is obese, and yet they're looking at models and other people as their role models. So it's still not entirely clear how this, you know, what is going on, but we think that this huge gap between the ideal and what actually is happening is a part of the problem. Now, recognizing that you're overweight and obese is difficult when everyone around you is overweight and obese. You don't look that much different. And so what some schools have done, for example, some school districts, some states, is to measure body mass index in children and to send it home like a report card so that parents know where their child fits in an effort to try to intervene early. And it's interesting that the response to that, you know, some parents are just shocked and upset, and they don't want to hear that this is the case. So that, you know, a lot of work has to go on in this area to help people to understand as soon as possible that they're overweight and obese. So I would say that this is under-recognized by a part of the population who has the biggest problem. But on the other hand, we have people who are normal weight and they want to be emaciated. Yep. So you have this sort of schism.
So is there a simple way, though, for, you know, the public to follow this? I know there's these scales. You can stand on them, and it tells you what your body fat index is. Is that a good way? Is there, does the American Medical Association have a strict definition of what obesity is and what it isn't?
There are definitions of obesity that are used by the World Health Organization and the American College of Physicians, for example. One of them is called the body mass index. The body mass index is a way to correct your weight for how tall you are. And it's the weight, your weight in pounds times 703 divided by your height in inches, and then you divide it by your height in inches again. And there are tables. The easiest way to figure this out is to look it up online. The National Institutes of Health Weight Information Network has a calculator. All you do is put in your weight and your height. It tells you what your BMI is.
So somebody can just go on the web and look up what again?
The NIH Weight Information Network, WIN, WIN.
Yeah.
And if you just put in NIH WIN, you'll find the BMI calculator.
And are there grades of obesity? You know, say your body mass index is it 5%, 10%, 100%, and when do you start to worry?
Well, the BMI numbers are actually, they work out quite well. So a BMI of 18.5 up to 25 is the normal range. A BMI of 25 to 30 is overweight. A BMI of 30 and above is obese. And within the range of obesity, there's moderate obesity and severe obesity. So we have seen patients with a body mass index as high as 95, a very severely obese patient. And there's another way to determine how overweight you are, and that is your waist measurement. So for a woman, a waist bigger than 30 inches, and for a man, a waist of 40 inches and above denotes an increase in risk.
So that's what one of the areas I wanted to get into. When you talk about obesity, are there levels of risk? So if you're mildly obese versus severely obese, does your risk profile increase for certain other disease processes?
Your risk increases for certain problems, but not for others. But in general, the heavier you are, the more body fat you have, the greater the risk. With some problems, the risk increases dramatically as you gain weight. So if we look at a problem like diabetes in women, the risk is increased 20-fold throughout the normal weight range into the overweight range. But other problems have very little risk as you increase body weight.
So we talk about risk. Can we put a name on it? What are the risk things that you're exposed to by being obese?
The health problems associated with obesity are many. One review showed 53 different health problems associated with obesity.
Which are the most common?
The most common ones: diabetes, high blood pressure, high triglycerides and a low level of good cholesterol, heart disease, stroke, cancers like cancer of the endometrium or cervix, breast cancer, colon cancer,
So again, all the things you see on the front pages of the Inquirer in terms of healthcare problems every day.
Well, I mean, the kind of problems we say in internal medicine. I mean, now I think we should say, if you know obesity, you know medicine, because every problem that we see in internal medicine is a problem that is made worse. It may not be caused by being overweight, but it's complicated by being overweight.
Is obesity today more common in children or in adults?
It's still more common in adults because the tendency over time is for people to gain weight, and very few people lose weight until they become in their 60s and 70s. So normally a higher percent of the population gains weight over time. But we're seeing obesity in children at a level we could never have imagined 10 or 15 years ago.
So it's more common today in children than it was 10 or 15 years ago.
Yes.
How about familial? Is it something like fat parents have fat kids, and is that the problem? Or
it's one of the most hereditary problems that we know of, but we're seeing trends like two normal weight parents who come, for example, from a foreign country. They move here, and all of a sudden their child is obese because the environment is different. So you take the genetic tendency to gain weight, you take the Western or American environment, and all of a sudden you have obesity.
So it's a combination then of both genetic factors and also just behavioral, environmental types of things.
That's right.
What is it, you said earlier in this segment that, you know, we have a slightly different understanding of metabolism. You know, what is metabolism, and, you know, why do we understand it, and how do we understand it better these days?
Well, what's happened in the past 15 years is that the discovery of a hormone that comes from fat cells, which tells the brain how much fat is stored, has revolutionized the field. First of all, it proved that your brain could tell that your fat cells stored fat and how much fat was stored there, and that this set off a whole bunch of processes that could stimulate metabolism or slow down metabolism or have an impact on how much you ate. And so now that we know that that exists, we've been able to work from there to work out all the pathways that control how much you eat, how full you feel, whether you crave, and then how many calories you burn.
It's funny, I was watching this movie that was out this summer, Little Miss Sunshine, and it's about a little girl who wants to go to a beauty pageant, and she orders ice cream at the restaurant, and her dad starts giving her grief about ordering ice cream and saying that, you know, that turns into fat cells, and fat cells go directly in your body, and you'll never be this model. Is there, in your practice, dealing with both, I presume, children and obese adults, Is there a lot of this psychological stress that goes on between parent and child?
It's a very complex relationship when a child is gaining weight, and also when a parent has a certain idea of what a child should look like, and if the child genetically doesn't have the tendency to be lean or they've started gaining weight, it can be a very tense situation, yes.
So as a parent, an active parent, how do we deal with that? I mean, what's the best way to help control our child's, if we see them gaining weight, what should we do?
Well, I think that some of the key factors are making sure they're eating a healthful diet, they're eating real food and a reasonable amount of it, they're not having too many sweet beverages. I think that that can stimulate appetite further, and there are many beverages that have empty calories and very little nutrition. And we know about junk food. We know that there are a tremendous number of calories, again, with no nutrition in them. That's just part of the problem. However, the exercise part is another big part of the equation that we're really not dealing with adequately.
So to summarize, one of the important thing that we said during this segment in terms of the individual that wants to know whether they're obese, they can go to the NIH webpage and find out about obesity and learn how to calculate their body mass index. And then that'll give them a strict measure of whether they have a problem with obesity and probably whether, as we'll talk about later, they should go speak to their physician.
That's right.
We're going to have to take a short break. Please stay with us, because when we return, we're going to talk about, once you know that you're obese, what are the risks associated with it, and why is it so hard to lose weight? Why don't you ever feel full? Please stay with us. Welcome back to How to Save Your Life. I'm Dr. Philip Stieg, and I have with me Dr. Louis Aroney, the former president of the North American Association for the Study of Obesity and an internationally acclaimed physician on the management of weight issues. In this segment, I want to focus on, once you understand that you have a weight problem, what are the risks, what are the health risks that go along with it, and why is it so hard to lose weight? Lou, in the first segment, you started listing some of the problems. I wanted you to go through that, and then we'll get into a little bit more detail about really how that problem affects their lives. I mean, what does it really mean to have some of those additional disorders on top of being obese?
Sure. The bottom line is that obesity is associated with more health problems than any other disease that we know of. And the way it works is by causing other health problems. So that problems like diabetes, heart disease, stroke, asthma, infertility, I mean, the list goes on and on. And obesity is often under-recognized as a cause of those health problems. That's one of the biggest problems that we've faced in trying to deal with it.
So are we saying, however, that if you have obesity and, say, diabetes, if you get the obesity under control, the diabetes will go away or be more easily controlled? And then what are the implications on your lifestyle with that?
For the person who's got adult-onset diabetes, almost all adult-onset diabetes is caused by being overweight. There are clearly some people, probably 10%, maybe 15% or fewer, who have adult-onset diabetes and are completely normal weight. But those people tend to get it when they're older, when they're in their 60s and 70s. What we're seeing now is that overweight teenagers, overweight 20-year-olds, 30-year-olds, they're developing adult-onset diabetes. Now, their parents may have developed it when they were 60. They're developing it when they're 30 or 20. So it accelerates the process. It accelerates the process of developing diabetes, heart disease, stroke, of aging, if you will. So it's really, we're talking about premature aging here.
And, you know, from your experience, how does that affect a person's life? I mean, from the standpoint of day-to-day activities, patient develops diabetes and heart disease. I mean, they're not running anymore. They're not getting out and enjoying life, I presume.
Diabetes and heart disease are two of the more severe complications that we associate with obesity, but they're the most common that we run into on a day-to-day basis. And it can have a huge impact on someone's lifestyle. Diabetics have a number of other associated health problems that can limit activity, so that preventing someone from going down that path, in my opinion, is really the way to go. You don't want them to get to the point where they develop the diabetes and heart disease. You want to roll back their weight and prevent them from ever getting there.
So it's kind of like, you know, the person who becomes a little bit obese, a little bit more obese, then they start getting the hypertension, they start taking hypertensive medications, then, you know, as you listen on TV now, the Viagra ads, they become less sexually potent, so now they start taking Viagra. I mean, you see this snowball effect, and, you know, how do you intervene? I mean, do you attack the individual problems? You say, wait a minute, we got to attack the weight problem, and then all of this other stuff will get better.
Well, our approach has been to try to treat the weight problem so that the typical person who comes to see us has diabetes, has high blood pressure, and has a high cholesterol. They may have a sleep disorder called sleep apnea, and they're being treated for all of those, or maybe they're not recognized. But by losing weight, those things get better or will go away completely. And so the thrust of our treatment has been to try to treat three or four different problems by getting at the underlying problem, which is too much fat.
I've never seen more sleep apnea than since I've moved to New York. Could you go into that a little bit so people would understand what it is? And, you know, I think a lot of people don't even know they have it.
Yeah, it's a very under-recognized problem that is commonly misdiagnosed. Sleep apnea is a sleep disorder in which people go to sleep and often feel like they're sleeping just fine, but when they get into the deepest levels of sleep, they stop breathing. And the reason they stop breathing is that their upper airway gets constricted by a combination of fat that is actually pressing on their neck. So a man or woman with a neck bigger than 17 inches, for example, is at an increased risk of having sleep apnea just because when they are in the deep level of sleep and their airway is relaxed, the fat compresses the airway when they take in a deep breath. They stop breathing, and they wake up ever so slightly. They can't really tell that they're awake, but it disrupts their sleep. The net result of that is that they never get the kind of rest that people need to function normally. They are chronically tired. Their blood pressure may go up. People may have bloodshot eyes. They may look depressed. And the worst part is they may gain more weight. So that you gain weight, you get to the point of sleep apnea, and you gain even more weight. Or you look depressed, and someone puts you on an antidepressant, and that makes you gain more weight. And so this is part of a vicious cycle that we've run into that, you know, we really need to get patients and physicians to recognize.
Can a person suffocate and die in the middle of their sleep from sleep apnea?
In severe cases, that has happened. So there are cases of that happening.
But it's rare.
It's rare. What can happen, however, is that your oxygen level can get very, very low. Just imagine holding your breath for 10, 15, 20 seconds. We've seen patients whose oxygen levels go down to 50%. And you know that you can develop an irregular heartbeat when your oxygen level gets that low. And we think that some people have a heart attack or irregular heartbeat in the middle of their sleep because of sleep apnea. So there are stories about people dying in their sleep in the middle of the night. We think that this is one of the risk factors for that.
Just a little bit earlier, you were referring to this vicious cycle that kind of gets going. The obesity brings on other disorders, and you know, just like with sleep apnea, you start to eat more, it makes the entire problem worse. And I assume that, you know, an obese person who's listening to this show is going to say you're preaching to the choir, but what are I want to do this from the perspective of both for the obese person, but also for people who love someone who is obese or has an obese child. What are the psychological problems that they go through knowing that they're in the middle of this vicious cycle, and how can we try to help them, our child or our loved one?
Well, one of the most difficult things about obesity is that it looks like it's so easy to treat. It's like, gee, why don't you just stop eating? Why don't you don't you recognize that this is a problem? I would liken this to telling a diabetic, well, you have diabetes, just get rid of that diabetes and control it. Get rid of your high blood pressure. Stop breathing. You're breathing too much oxygen. We need to save on oxygen. I mean, there are many analogies we could use where it looks like you could do that, but it is very difficult to do. So anyone who lives with someone who's overweight or obese has to realize that it's much more difficult to lose weight than you can imagine. And you need to be supportive. You need to try to help someone to recognize the problem and see it, but don't be surprised if they're very sensitive to it, because they know it's there. They don't want to do these things, but we find that it's very difficult for them to comply.
Do you think that, number one, obese people, do the majority of obese people appreciate that they're obese and they don't like it? Or is it the other, you know, they learn how to live with it, they're adapting to their situation. And then, again, from the perspective of a person who's not obese, how should they approach the person who's obese?
I think most people who are obese know that they're overweight, they don't like it, they don't like eating as much as they're eating, if that's part of the problem, but they find that they can't do anything about it. If they try to do something, they feel uncomfortable. So not eating makes them feel uncomfortable. If anyone doesn't believe me, just don't eat for 24 hours, drink water, tell me how you feel. You'll feel terrible. Anybody would feel that way. And people who are overweight and obese, when they cut down on their food intake, feel that way. They seem to be more sensitive to that. So how do you help somebody? It can be a very difficult process. But I think support and encouragement is really the way to go.
Just a moment ago, you were referring to how hard it is to lose weight. Why is it so hard? Is it because, you know, I mean, you read in the magazines about the addiction to carbohydrates. Is it because you know, I love bread and I have a craving for bread, or I love chocolate cake and I have a craving, and again, that starts the cycle. Is there something organic about it, genetic about it? Is it all of these things? Can you enlighten us a little bit?
The evidence is that now that if you start feeding foods that we call fattening foods. Like, did you ever think about that? What's fattening about fattening food? It looks like it breaks down the weight regulating mechanisms relatively quickly so that the body can't sense how much food is coming in and how much fat is stored. And what that does is allows you to eat more food. So it actually physically breaks down these signaling processes in a way that makes you lose your sense of fullness. And people who have this know just what I'm talking about. It's like the more you eat, the hungrier you get. And it's with certain foods that this actually happens. And people are trying to understand how this happens and what the process is. But there's a lot of research going on in this area right now. And so you start eating, and it sort of drives you to eat a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more. Then you've consumed too many calories, and you start gaining weight.
So I don't know if I understood you. So, the people that have a tendency to become obese would start breaking down the food more rapidly so that they don't feel full?
It's not that they actually break the food down more rapidly. It's that the signaling processes from the stomach and the intestine to the brain that tell you that you're full, those signals are not properly received when you feed fattening food. And that seems to be one of the key processes that goes on that allows people with a tendency to overweight and obesity to begin to gain weight. And as time goes on, this starts to cause other processes, resistance to the effects of insulin, a hormone that controls blood sugar, resistance to leptin, a hormone from fat cells that tells the brain how much fat is stored, and that the resistance to those hormones is another key step in allowing more food to be consumed and metabolism to be suppressed. When you look at these processes together, it begins a vicious cycle that leads to increasing weight gain.
So this loss of sense of fullness, is that somewhere located in the brain? Or can we image it? Can we get some kind of PET scan, MR scan, or something that shows us that you have... when you age, you're going to have the propensity to become obese?
It hasn't been done clinically. In other words, where a patient comes in and where that kind of research is done. But in a research setting, it is being done right now. So researchers are looking at this, and it has been demonstrated that this is, in fact, part of the problem and that it probably is the best single target for treatment for preventing people from gaining weight in the future. So we're talking about things that we'll be doing, 5-10 years in the future, but it is very clear that this is probably the best target we have.
Is obesity because of a food addiction in many cases, or is it just some people have a metabolic problem, or both?
It depends on how you define addiction. So if you look at certain models of addictive behavior, it's possible to say that certain foods are, in fact, addictive in certain individuals. I wouldn't say that all foods are addictive, but I think that there are some which, when they're withdrawn, give symptoms that make people want them again. So very intensely sweet foods, for example, if they're withdrawn, they trigger cravings and thinking about them that could fall under the term addiction.
Because I was thinking just about the concept of enabling individuals, and as a concerned parent, or again, a concern for a loved one, what role we play in helping them become obese. And again, is it letting them eat specific kinds of foods and trying to steer them away from it?
Well, steering children completely away is may lead to a rebound someplace else. And so it's very difficult in any given situation to sort of give blanket advice. I think that parents need to sort of monitor the situation and be working with somebody who understands this problem to get the kind of result that may be necessary. In some cases, trying to keep a child away from certain foods will backfire later on because they'll they'll go out and find it at somebody else's house. But in other cases, the child just doesn't know that that's a problem and it needs to be pointed out to them. So, again, it just depends on the situation what the right approach is.
What I find amazing is, again, there's a lot of people walking out there with a little bit of a tire around their waist, and they say that they're obese and they got to go on this crash diet, and me being one of them. And you go to the grocery store and you start trying to regulate what you're putting in your mouth. Are greater measures being done to help us? I mean, I'll look at a package, and I, for the life of me, cannot tell what's in that food. They're very good at listing sodium and potassium, you know, free fat, and that. Now there's this big kick about trans fats. But is that going to get better so we know what we're putting into our bodies?
Well, one of the biggest problems is portion size. So that you may read that there are 100 calories in a portion, but it won't necessarily be clear that there are 5 portions in that package. So we've seen this happen where someone will be eating a snack food, for example, and they'll say, well, it's got 100 calories, but actually it's 100 calories in one portion, and there are 5 portions in that particular bag. So you have to multiply the number of calories times the number of portions to see how many calories there are in the entire bag of food.
Yeah. Another thing that might cause problems in this day and age where, you know, so many people are on different medications, what are some of the common medications out there that you see that create problems for patients?
Well, this is a major area of interest now with the recognition that there are medicines that can cause weight gain and make people more likely to gain weight. Probably the most common area where we can see weight gain or medicines for things like depressed mood, schizophrenia, that can cause weight gain, and enough weight gain, people can develop diabetes.
Now, they cause the weight gain by affecting your metabolism, or they change the way you consume food?
They do both. We see that some people take these medicines, lose their sense of fullness very, very quickly. Other people develop cravings. Some people don't seem to eat very much more, but they still start gaining weight. So, whole variety of problems. The important point is that there are now enough medications for these problems out there that often another medicine can be substituted, and that can prevent the problem from occurring. We just saw a young man before I came here who has lost 60 pounds just by changing around the medications for his mood problem, for his depression. That is a huge victory, because he was quite ill, developing diabetes, and just by changing these medicines around, he's finally able to stick with the diet.
So within a class of drugs, like medications used to treat depression, there are some drugs that have a weight problem associated with it and others that don't?
Yes.
And you should be able to ask your doctor, your psychiatrist, I presume, which ones do and don't if you start noticing that problem.
It's a very complex area. We just don't have time to discuss it, but that is the case. But it's also true for medicines for diabetes. It's true for some blood pressure medicines and some heart medicines. Medicines for prostate problems can do it. Even medicines for sleep. Some over-the-counter sleep remedies that have strong antihistamines can cause weight gain.
Quick response about alcohol, excessive drinking. Is it a weight problem? Does it cause weight problems?
It can. It can increase cravings for sweets and has a lot of calories.
Again, we're going to have to take a short break, but please stay with us. In the next segment, I want to focus on what works in reducing weight. We'll talk about all the different diet plans out there and also about the over-the-counter drugs that you can purchase. Please stay with us. Welcome back to How to Save Your Life. I'm your host, Dr. Philip Stieg, and with me is Dr. Louis J. Aroney, former president of the North American Association for the Study of Obesity and internationally acclaimed physician in the management of obesity. Louis, during this segment, I wanted to get everybody to start focusing on what are the kinds of things that they can do once they know they're fat and they know that they're starting to have the associated health problems with obesity. From your perspective, is it better to try to fix it myself, or should the person get medical assistance, see a doctor, someone like you who's going to guide them through the process, or can I go buy the Atkins book or the South Beach book and do that?
I think that many people can do this on their own, but some people just can't. And if you've made the effort to lose and you've not been able to lose between 5 and 10% of your body weight, then you may want to think about taking further steps. But I think that many people can lose as much weight as we need them to lose for better health. Again, 5 to 10% of their total body weight, and they can do it on their own. But if they can't, then I think something should be done.
During the break, we were talking a little bit about the different kinds of diets out there. Again, the Atkins, the South Beach, and not being in your field, I don't know all the names of the different diets. But you were intimating that we understand now why they work. So on the flip side of it, there's a lot of diet bashing. How do they work? What are the things that are going on?
Well, the most important point is that diets do work, that changing what you eat and how much you eat can reduce your body weight. Is it going to reduce it to the weight you've been dreaming of for the past 10 years? No, but it could help you to lose about 5 to 10% of your total body weight. Now, the different diets that are out there differ in the composition of the food, whether or not you're counting calories or not. The bottom line is the evidence shows that people do better on diets that they like, so that there's no one diet that's best for everybody. It's the diet that you like the best that's the best one for you. But I would caution people that unbalanced diets are not good, so that if you eat only cabbage for the next year, will you lose weight? Absolutely, but it's not very healthy, even though cabbage is healthy. So that we want people to eat real food. We want them to eat enough of certain types of foods to get good nutrition. But other than that, we're pretty flexible when it comes to diet instruction.
So are there, if you stick to one of these diets, are they set up so that you get all the nutrients, elements, and will lose weight and you don't have to worry? Or do you have concerns about the person that goes, gung-ho for whichever diet they select, and are there risks associated with it?
There are definitely risks associated with dieting too strictly. Will it kill you? That's very, very uncommon. But people can develop kidney stones, they can develop gallstones. All kinds of side effects have been recorded with very strict dieting. So the more flexible you are, believe it or not, the less likely you are to have side effects from any kind of a diet.
So what's your message to the people out there listening? Is it something that, can you do it yourself? In your experience, the people you deal with, is it that they haven't been able to do it themselves and that's why they finally come to you? So should you get either someone else who's doing the same thing you're doing or a nutritionist or a doctor to help you work through this?
Well, everybody is welcome to try on their own, but if it doesn't work, that doesn't mean that you can't lose weight. It may mean that you need more support. So going to a group, groups definitely help people to lose more weight. It may be that you'd benefit from taking medication. There are a number of different things. It may be that you're on a medication that's making it difficult for you to lose. So don't give up, I guess, is the message that I'm giving you. But make sure you have a realistic expectation that, if you can lose at least 5 or 10% of your body weight, you're doing a good job.
So that seems to be, I've heard you say that now a couple of times, the end game should be about a 5 to 10% loss of your weight. And that just brings to my mind, the recent episode on, what was it, Oprah or wherever, where the actress came out in a bikini having lost, a significant amount of weight. Is that a realistic expectation for people?
That's a completely unrealistic expectation of what can be done. Some people find that that's motivating. I don't think that it's a good idea, because I think that people compare themselves to someone like that. I mean, this is also seen in a TV show, The Biggest Loser. You know, The Biggest Loser defies physical aspects that we understand about obesity. If you lose a lot of weight one week, the next week you're not going to lose a lot of weight and you're going to get thrown out of the house. You know, so these kinds of TV representations of weight loss are infuriating, in my opinion, and just don't represent what we recommend for the average person, nor what is achievable.
So you're recommending realistic expectations, which are, 10% body weight, and then presumably a more gradual weight loss. And give us a time frame. I mean, if I want to lose 10% of my body weight, over what time frame should I expect to do that?
12 weeks. Three months would be a very reasonable period of time. So you're losing 2 pounds a week. That would be a very reasonable pace, and you're going to lose over that period of time somewhere between 15 and 20 pounds. That is good weight loss, because the first weight you lose is the healthiest weight. It takes a lot of metabolic pressure off your body. It improves your insulin sensitivity, improves your blood pressure, improves all the factors that we're looking for. That is our goal.
So during that 12-week period, am I always going to be hungry?
Not necessarily, and that's one of the tricks. That's what we're seeking, so that getting people to starve to lose weight is not part of the program. And that's why using different types of diets, using a low-fat, high-carbohydrate diet for one person and a higher-fat and lower-carbohydrate diet for someone else is the way to go, because some people feel full on one diet and others feel better with another diet.
So for the person you were referring to, these different body mass indexes, and I think, 30 was really a bad number, or above 30. So I can't imagine then that only losing 10% of your weight is doing that much for you. I would think in that situation you'd recommend the person lose more than 10%. But do you like to think in 10% increments, so that over 12 weeks we lose 10% and now we've, all right, now we're in the groove and we're going to start going and we might lose another 10%?
Well, you'd like to think that that's the case. And, again, we don't stop anybody from losing weight. But research shows that there are metabolic resistance points to weight loss. In other words, you start losing weight and your body stops you from losing because it thinks you're starving to death. And this is not just theoretical. We know how it happens. We know at what point it happens. And we even know how we're going to overcome it in the future.
So does it happen at 10%?
It can happen. In some people, I think it happens at 2 or 3%. In other people, it's 15, 20, 30%, as you see in some of these examples of extreme weight loss. I mean, we have people, I saw a guy today, he's lost 200 pounds with diet, exercise, and the appropriate treatment of his diabetes. 200 pounds, 50% of his body weight. Does that happen all the time? No. But does it happen sometimes? Absolutely.
So what's different about that 400-pound person and the person who's, 200 pounds and should be 175?
Well, the difference is that he was in heart failure, that he had a sleep disorder, that he was put on 6 different medications and has 5 small children and was deathly afraid of leaving them. And that made him realize that he had to change some very basic things, and he's become quite compliant after not caring at all about how much he weighed and how much he ate. So by changing around what he ate, he was able to overcome the metabolic resistance that we see in people. So again, I'm not saying that it's not possible for people to lose more weight. I'm telling you what the average person will lose when they're put on a diet.
So I'm an anxious kind of guy. And, I want the quick fix, and I turn on, what station is it on TV, and I hear about these over-the-counter drugs for $19.99, and I try them. What are they? What are your thoughts about them? Can you enlighten me? Because I really don't know much other than the fact that I'd be spending money to get a quick fix.
Well, the Federal Trade Commission helped us last week by pointing out that there's really no medication that delivers the way promised in these ads. You know, in my review of the literature, I don't see any product that is sold over the counter that causes the kind of weight loss that is claimed in these kinds of ads. They just don't work the way they're said to work. And it's a shame because I think people are wasting their money, they're wasting their effort, they're deluding themselves into thinking that they're going to have an outcome that is really good when, in fact, there's no evidence that that's going to happen.
What size of a business, what magnitude of business are we talking about here?
Well, this is a massive business. I mean, you might say that this is a massive business fraud going on in the United States and in front of everybody, that, you know, these products are being sold for people with a disease state, obesity, and there's no evidence that they work. There's no evidence that they're safe. And yet they're marketed in a very similar way. And it's not just by small manufacturers. I mean, you go, I was looking online and saw in one of these large big box stores that they had 25 different products like this for sale. And I can tell you that there's no evidence that any of those products does anything for your body weight. So people are wasting an enormous amount of time, money, and effort on over-the-counter products. What they should be doing is eating healthfully.
What about these other devices? You know, you see that they stick on, they have a little electrical charges and that. Do those things work?
They're a joke.
They're a joke.
You know, again, same kind of idea. I think I have one of those to do home neurosurgery. You know, but the point is that there are any number of products like that out there. Anything you can imagine, people will come up with to try to make a quick buck. And it's because weight is such a complex problem, but it's beginning to yield its secrets to scientists, and I'm hopeful that we're going to have some really good treatments in the coming years.
So throughout this hour, I mean, what I want to do is dispel, a myth that you got to go and buy over-the-counter stuff, you got to go and buy one of these electrical heater chargers to work the fat off your abdomen. Is somebody better off spending whatever it costs to go have at least one consultation with a nutritionist or a physician who specializes in this and tries to help and guide them through it?
That might be a good idea. One of the problems with that idea is there aren't that many people who know what they're doing, who specialize in this area, and there are many charlatans in the area. So there are people who claim that they know what they're doing, but how do you know that they do? This is one of the areas that I've been interested in at the Obesity Society and in my role as an authority in the field, that we need to begin credentialing physicians so we know who are the people who really know what they're talking about. The fact is that anybody can go out and hang up a sign and say that they're a nutrition expert.
And the web page probably isn't much protection. I mean, somebody just put a web page out there. So there must be some guideline, or at least a guide to who is good, say through the American Medical Association or something like that. I mean, just give me some hope. Where do we find your name?
You would find my name on the website of the Obesity Society, the North American Association for the Study of Obesity. But at the same time, I can't say that every single member of NASO, you know, that we don't have a test, we don't have anything. It's just that, you know, I was the president. So there, right now, I would say that members of NASO are among the authorities in the field. But I also have to say that there's no testing. There is no authoritative source that I would say is really where people can look. And this is a job that needs to be done, and people like me are working on how we can begin to credential physicians in this area. I think that for dietitians, however, we do have credentialing. So there are dietitians who have credentialing in the area of obesity. You can find them on the American Dietetic Association website.
So that would be a reasonable place to start, and then hopefully a dietitian would have a physician that they've worked with in the past.
My opinion for the average person who's out there listening to this is that that might be a good way to go. Looking at academic institutions, so a lot of institutions like ours, Cornell, have programs associated with them now. I think you're going to find high-quality people at those kinds of institutions. When I look around, Harvard has programs, Boston University, I mean, all the big institutions now are developing programs like ours because obesity is on the forefront of medical science.
That's what I was going to say. I would presume that this is going to be much more common. There will be divisions on obesity, I would think, because of what you were referring to earlier, the increased incidence of children that are overweight.
Well, the interest has never been greater. We're seeing people interested in doing fellowships with us where 5 or 10 years ago there really was very little interest. So I think in the coming years, I'm very optimistic that physicians and other healthcare professionals are going to take on this battle, and we're going to win.
What I'm curious about is, you know, the New York Times is writing on its front page that over the next couple of decades, we can expect people to live to be 100. With all the disease processes that you're outlining associated with obesity and the increased incidence of obesity, it somewhat seems to be, it isn't congruous. I mean, what's happening here?
Well, that's correct. There are other estimates that if weight keeps increasing the way it is, that there's actually going to be a decrease in life expectancy in the coming generation, mainly because of the number of cases of diabetes due to obesity. So while it will be possible for some people to live to 100, I think there'll be many others who live a shorter lifespan than they would have lived 10, 15, 20 years in the past.
Why, when people quit smoking, do they gain weight? I mean, what's going on?
Nicotine is a very powerful metabolic stimulant. It deals with many of the craving mechanisms and prevents people from eating as well. And when you take that away, the average person gains somewhere between 5 and 7% of their body weight. So smokers tend to be underweight compared to the population.
Dr. Aroney, it's been a real honor and a pleasure to have you here on How to Save Your Life. I believe that the listeners will have gained an immense amount of information about what obesity is, why it is so hard to lose weight, and then what might be the good diet plan for them. And hopefully they'll start coming to physicians like you that can help them. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Phil.